When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, this is Martina Navratilova, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. This isn't David Law after consuming some helium. This is Catherine Whittaker. We're having a bit of a role reversal this week, but I am, of course, joined by David Law in the Putney Exchange. David, it's wonderful to be back, isn't it?
Where else could we possibly be? I can't believe you've name-checked them after saying you wouldn't last week, so random shopping centre it is.
I'm not name-checking the coffee shop we're in, that's for sure. They're not getting anything out of us for free. Now, we have quite the jam-packed show coming up. I'm sure you can probably guess what our headline discussion topic is going to be, and we will come on to that very, very soon, rest assured. But first of all, we do have a fairly major, big interview this week with the newly re-elected CEO of men's tennis of the ATP, Chris Comeau. David has hot-footed it from the Queen's Club, where he's been chatting to Chris. How was he, David?
It was very well. I mean, as you say, it's there's a lot to talk about this week generally, and there's been a lot for him to deal with over the last couple of months. But yeah, I've just spent half an hour with Chris in his office at the Queen's Club. We've touched on all the significant topics of the day, the match-fixing allegations that surfaced during the Australian Open, obviously the anti-doping issues of the last 7 days. We've also been talking about the future of the game as he sees it, some big changes potentially to the actual fundamental elements of the game that are going to be trialled over the next couple of years. So it was an interesting chat. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, he's a no-nonsense guy, Chris, isn't he? Gives a very punchy interview. It's very interesting. Do listen at the end of the show for that. But of course, first of all, we have to talk Maria Sharapova and the events that have unfolded over the last week. We, of course, recorded that supplementary segment at the beginning of the last podcast to cover off her announcement on Monday evening UK time of last week. But that was recorded in the very immediate aftermath. A lot of the information that we were getting was coming from Twitter, and it was changing all the time. We've had a whole week now, and boy, has my internet search history looked quite bizarre over the last week. The amount of research I've done about meldonium and various different things. So I think before we get into discussion of the various very complicated, very muddy issues at the heart of this news story, I think I'll just give you a brief summary of what we've learned over the last week about this situation. I'll try to stick to the facts here, the facts of what we learned over the past week. Meldonium, the drug that Maria Sharapova has tested positive for, is used to treat ischemia, which is a lack of blood flow to parts of the body, particularly in cases of angina or heart failure. It's manufactured in Latvia and only distributed in Baltic countries and Russia. It's not approved by the FDA in the States nor in the rest of Europe. WADA found evidence of its use by athletes with the intention of of enhancing performance by virtue of carrying more oxygen to muscle tissue. The decision to add meldonium to the banned list was approved on the 16th of September 2015 and then came into effect on the 1st of January 2016. WADA had spent the previous year monitoring the drug, as they always do, before adding it to the banned list. All players were sent 5 communications in December warning that the substance would be banned from January 1st. Sharapova's management responded to that in a statement saying whether it was one notice or more than one, Maria has already acknowledged she should have known. And Sharapova also then added in a message to fans on her Facebook page that these communications were buried in newsletters, websites or handouts. Several athletes have been suspended since the turn of 2016 after testing positive for the same drug. Among several others was Abebe Aregawi, the 2013 women's 1500 metres world champion. She's been suspended provisionally after meldonium was found in a sample she provided as well. But there are countless other athletes. You can look all of them up online. Sharapova says she has been taking the drug for 10 years after she was regular falling ill. She had a magnesium deficiency and a family history of diabetes. And she says she will provide medical and documentary evidence at her hearing that will prove this. The preliminary hearing has to take place before March the 23rd, and then there'll be a subsequent hearing within 60 days after that. Nike has suspended its $70 million deal with Sharapova. Tag Heuer, the watch manufacturer, announced that it would not be renewing its contract with her, and Porsche said it would not be doing any imminent activities with Sharapova. Head, meanwhile, her racket sponsor, have said they are proud to stand behind her and have said they intend to extend her contract. So a very different stance from Head. Now that's the bombardment of facts for the time being.
Can you run that by me again?
Yeah, that's just a mere sample of my internet search history from the past week. And there has been so much volume of stuff written in the various papers. I think the way the British papers have covered it, a lot of that stuff comes courtesy of The Guardian, The Times, really quality journalism. I mean, many differing opinions, but really high quality journalism over the past week covering this big story. Just a little summary, what's been very interesting is how her fellow players have responded to this development, and there's been such a wide range of opinion among her fellow players, and I think that reflects how muddy this moral maze is and how many layers of issues there are within this one news story. Just a quick summary: Belinda Bencic, who of course lost to Maria Sharapova in Australia where she tested positive, said she didn't want to comment on the situation and she doesn't think it made any difference on that day. Plenty of other players sort of sitting on the fence or not being prepared to comment, I suppose, understandably. Stan Wawrinka, he said it's tough to say anything if it's not on the list, which of course it wasn't up until January 2016. Novak Djokovic has said, as a friend, he's called Sharapova courageous and brave for publicly taking responsibility for testing positive. But as a player concerned about the sport, he said, quote, if she was caught to be positive on the doping for a certain substance, then there should be a certain kind of consequences for that. And a development in the past 24 hours, David, has been John McEnroe having his say. Very interestingly, he has said, if a drug is legal, then it's a no-brainer. I mean, are you kidding? You can practically hear John saying these words, can't you? I mean, are you kidding? He said, people have been always looking since the beginning of time for an edge, and if you're constantly looking for these things in any way, shape or form, then it's a no-brainer. He said it would be hard to believe, though, that no one in her camp, the 25 or 30 people that worked for her, or Maria herself, had no idea that this happened. On the other side of the coin, we've got some players that have been slightly more critical of Sharapova. Rafael Nadal, who's had his own barrage of doping-related questions to deal with this week. He's announced today, or not announced, he's said today that he intends to sue the former French sport and health minister who's cast aspersions on his time out of the sport in 2012 with completely no foundation, it seems. And he's been very bullish about how he and his team intend to deal with those aspersions. But on the subject of Maria Sharapova, he said, I want to believe that for sure it was a mistake for Maria. She didn't want to do it. But it is a result of negligence. So the rules are like this. It's fair. She must pay for it. Jeannie Bouchard said, I was very shocked and disappointed. Sharapova was an idol of mine growing up. To think of your childhood idol and wonder if it was a lie, it really affected me a lot. Serena Williams, of course, many of you will have heard her statement in the immediate aftermath saying most people were happy that she was she, being Sharapova, was upfront and honest, and that showed a lot of courage. Lots of people echoing those thoughts. But then supplementarily, she said in the past couple of days, I don't take any supplements. I'm terrified by it. And I think it would be a really bad situation if it was me. I think it's disappointing for all the players who work very hard. However, I don't think it reflects on everyone. We have all been playing since we were four or five. I'm sure lots of you heard how aggrieved Jennifer Capriati has been. She launched a big Twitter response to it all. And I just want to touch on Andy Murray and his response to it. He is no nonsense about doping, isn't it? No fence sitting for him. He said, I think taking a prescription drug that you don't necessarily need just because it's legal, that is wrong. Clearly, that's wrong. If you're taking a prescription drug and you're not using it for what the drug was meant for, then you don't need it. You're just using it for the performance enhancing benefits, and I don't think that's right. And in regard to Head, who's his racket sponsor as well, in regard to their decision, he said, I personally wouldn't have responded like that, which is pretty hard line to take, isn't it, considering how many players have been slightly dodging the subject. Now, I'm just going to take a little breather from talking for a moment, David, and I'm going to throw you the very broad, open question of what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I'm exhausted just listening to all that, but it's such an emotive subject, isn't it, on a number of levels, because as you hear, people have such differing viewpoints for a start. I think, first of all, the facts as we know them are that she's tested positive. She's saying that this is a substance she has been given and prescribed by doctors for health conditions, and for 10 years she took it. And then she was negligent. She's agreed to that. She's admitted to that. She said, that's the reason I've ended up testing positive. That's all there is to it. So from her perspective, you can take away all those suggestions that she was trying to enhance her performance by taking this substance. That's her stance. I don't have any evidence to contradict that. I do know, and I've read about the number of many other cases in sports that we've heard of in recent days since January the 1st of athletes testing positive for meldonium, which, yeah, again, raises a number of question marks as to, are they all testing positive because of having been prescribed this drug for health reasons, and have they all therefore been negligent in not stopping in time? There's also the question mark over whether players are taking notice of the information they're given. Sharapova in that Facebook statement mentioning how five times she was supposedly told about this stuff, and she's showing us all the documents and things like that and listing the details of why it's so hard to keep on top of this, whilst not trying to suggest that she should have done it differently. She's saying that I got it wrong. I didn't notice that one email. But the bottom line is, that's what we know. There is now going to be a process that takes place. There is, you know, you talked about the morality of this last week and the immediate aftermath, and we heard the words of John McEnroe, which is something he's echoing to some degree what you said last week, that, you know, why wouldn't you, if there are rules in place, why wouldn't you push to the very limit of it? Now, that then comes down to where you stand on things morally, doesn't it?
Well, this is, I think, where we should head with the debate now, because, as you say, the facts of the Maria Sharapova case are yet to be established. We eagerly await that hearing. She says she's going to produce medical documentary evidence that proves that she wasn't taking meldonium for performance-enhancing purposes.
If she does, I think we've just, you know, and if that is accepted, you just have to take that on its merits. What else can you do? I mean, I accept other people may have a different opinion. My own one is that I'm going to accept the ruling in that regard.
Okay, but as I say, I'm going to steer the debate in a different direction, because we can't say much about the specifics of the Sharapova case because so much is yet to be said, but it does open up this debate about the fact are Meldonium is proved to have performance enhancing properties. That doesn't mean there isn't a legitimate reason for taking it in some cases as well, but that's why it's been placed on the ban list, because it does have performance enhancing properties, and it's taken a long time to get it onto the ban list. Now, is it just that, I mean, the win at all costs attitude, that determined, gritty commitment to victory at any cost, is something that we admire in an athlete, isn't it? Is that just simply not compatible necessarily with acting within the spirit of the law? Because there's a difference between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, isn't it? Are those two things just perhaps not necessarily compatible?
It's a really difficult one, because for me, I would love it if they would ban everything. That there would be, that it could be utterly black and white in that regard. That if, you know, that you basically exist on water and food, and let's see who is the best human being at a particular sport. That is my ideal. Now, I'm probably naive. That's probably not possible.
I don't think you are naive.
No, but I think it's probably just not possible to be able to run a doping program like that and be as zero tolerance to the point of that. Otherwise, why wouldn't we be doing it? It must be that difficult. And, you know, I was actually talking via messages with Richard Ings, who's obviously hugely experienced in this field from his time at the ATP. And I was curious, because I downloaded the app, the WADA app, to find Meldonium on it. I also looked up Mildronate, which is what Maria Sharapova had initially said, this is what I've been taking, and I now know it's known as Meldonium as well. Mildronate, you can't see it on the app. It's not there. Meldonium obviously is, and that's part of the argument she was making. I just remember back probably 15, 20 years ago when we were all talking about creatine, this supplement which so many of the athletes were using, and there were a lot of question marks over it. And I was asking Richard, you know, is that on the list? Because I can't find it on the app, and it wasn't then, and it isn't now. And I was curious as to why that is. And he said, you know, that there are actually three criteria for a substance getting on the banned list, and it has to satisfy two out of the three in order to be on there. And those three criteria are that it enhances performance, that it is dangerous to your health, and that it is contrary to the integrity of the sport.
But on that first point, I believe the wording of it is you have to see a pattern of players using it to enhance performance. So they're not preempting the fact that this drug could possibly be used to enhance performance. So should we ban it before athletes start using it for that purpose? They monitor and they see what athletes are using. Is that sort of reactive approach just not sufficient?
Well, look, in an ideal world, as I say, I would much rather it if they just banned everything. And if you've got a cold or if you've got a condition, kind of too bad. You know, I know that might sound harsh, and there may be people with chronic problems, or there may be people with real health difficulties that are being kept under wraps, or at least keeping players on the court at all by taking them. But to me, that is the black and white way around this. But I just don't think it is realistic. So in terms of the moral element to it, I mean, I certainly don't feel particularly comfortable with somebody taking it to boost their performance until it becomes illegal. Then I think I can see why some of these other players are saying, well, hold on, you know, that player played against me while they were using what we now regard as a banned substance. I think if it's a mistake, it's black and white. No, you know, the person pays for the mistake, not for the moral decision to enhance their own performance. If it can be proved, and I don't know how you would prove it, that somebody is taking it because they know it enhances their performance despite it not being on the ban list, it's not something that I feel particularly comfortable with either.
It is interesting, though, David, isn't it, to see the wide range of opinion from fellow players, because I think on the moral side of things, one of the main arguments against doping is that it gives you an unfair advantage that your fellow players don't have, whereas I think a lot of players are saying, well, if this was legal, then there was nothing unfair about her taking it. It didn't give her an advantage that I couldn't have had if I'd wanted to seek that sort of thing out. Do you think that contributes to perhaps some of the really, really vast array of opinion among fellow players on both the WTA and ATP tours?
Yeah, and I think that there are probably some players as well who don't take any supplements for fear of potentially crossing an illegal line.
Well, that's precisely what Serena Williams said. She says she's terrified of supplements.
Well, I remember back in the day, Tim Henman saying, you know, I feel as though all I can take is water and to be absolutely, completely, 100% confident. And just anecdotally, 20 years ago, this non-athlete sitting in front of you right now decided to have a go at weight training, right? To transform his puny, embarrassing physique into something relatively acceptable in today's society. And I actually took creatine. I actually had a bit of this stuff when I was doing my weight training. And there is no question about it that it actually enabled me to train harder and lift more weights. Now, that is apparently allowed. I don't get why. Apparently, it's because it only fulfills one of the three criteria that needs to be fulfilled for it to enter the banned list. But that's why it's such a grey area for me, I think, for everybody. And, you know, as I said, the more you can ban, the better, as far as I'm concerned. I just want to find out who's the best athlete. Bottom line.
That's the thing. I mean, for me, where the moral line lies is, I mean, I've made this argument not in relation to doping before. I remember back in the days of yonder, David, when I wasn't a Roger Federer fan, I remember trying to explain why that was, and I just couldn't relate to him. He seemed too superhuman, too serene, he bore no relation to human beings as I know them. And I think that is the core issue for me morally. It's about relatability. In order to be able to fully appreciate these athletes, you need to be able to relate to them. They need to be the best of us physically. And if you start to feel that they're not of us somehow, that's a change in the landscape for me.
And that is the beauty of Roger Federer, that he's been able to do this with those innate gifts that he was born with, and he's been able to nurture through natural training methods and the skill he's developed. But you're absolutely right. I watched the 100 metres final in Seoul live when Ben Johnson thrashed a field of competitors, and it was so exciting at the time, and it was so crushing to find out that it was all a sham. And this is what we have to try to avoid in sports today, by having the right sort of anti-doping program that can catch the real cheats and stop that from happening. It would just be nice if the lines weren't blurred at all. And to me, the more you can ban, the better chance you have of removing those blurred lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably the world of everyone with a vested interest in sports, spectator, people that work in sport would probably agree with you, but then there are practical considerations that we just don't know about. I mean, I've tried to do as much Googling as possible about just how hard it is to even develop the tests for some of these things. I mean, it's more easy with a substance like meldonium that's artificial, but lots of these things are naturally occurring things in one's body anyway that people are just trying to enhance their levels of. I mean, I can't begin to imagine the scientific complexities of trying to test for that. So there are factors at play here that we probably can't appreciate the minutiae of as much as we've tried in the past week. But look, this is going to rumble for a long time. We haven't even had the preliminary hearing yet, and we will learn a lot more after that. So of course there will be more discussion on this in podcasts to come. Tennis has actually been happening, though, amazingly. Actual striking of tennis balls over in Indian Wells, which just looks disgustingly nice, Indian Wells, doesn't it? I mean, as lovely as it is in the Putney Exchange, it's no tennis garden, is it?
It's not, no. I've had the pleasure of reporting from Indian Wells on two occasions, and my word, was it good. Beautiful temperatures, lovely air, and just fantastic tournament as well. I mean, what a tournament they put on there. And it's, you know, it was 2007 and 08 when I went there, and even since then, it's one of those that every single year you expect to be better than the year before, and I think it really is one of the players' favourites, understandably.
There are some players who haven't enjoyed it particularly this year, though. Angelique Kerber, she lost in straight sets to Denise Alatova. Expected, do you think, a little bit of a lull after Australia? Because, I mean, she, prior to becoming a Grand Slam champion, she was best known for her consistency. So this is a little bit out of the blue, isn't it?
No, this wasn't expected for me. Yeah, she might have had a hangover. You might expect that. But to not win a match, more or less, since the Australian Open, and Denise Alatova is a good player. She also lost to Belinda Bencic, who's a good player. She's lost the week after that. I watched in the Middle East, she lost as well. But this is unusually a fall from a strong position of winning a Grand Slam to not being able to win a match. Now, I don't know why that is. I haven't heard too much from her, but, you know, it does come with a different pressure, certainly. I remember Yevgeny Kafelnikov getting to number one in the world and losing his next six matches straight after becoming world number one. I remember being at the tournaments that he was at, and it's horrible, really, in terms of when you want to kind of celebrate a massive achievement and then you see somebody struggling so abjectly. But, you know, it's only three matches, isn't it?
Yeah, it is only three matches. A very, very, I think, a very tough loss to take last night for Grigor Dimitrov to Alex Zverev. I mean, the narrative is almost too cutely poetic to say, but, you know, he was once that next generation, and here he is losing in a very disappointing way, I think, because he was a breakup in that third set to the now current next generation of Alex Zverev. I mean, that's got to be a tough pill to swallow for him, hasn't it?
Well, a disappointing win, and frankly an all too familiar way just at the moment over the last year or so for Grigor. He needs to find a way to reboot, go back to the basics that got him to a semi-final of Wimbledon, to winning at Queen's, to doing all the things that, well, frankly, got this tennis podcast so excited over the years, because he's still a joy to watch. Let's make no bones about it. And I saw that match, the last two sets last night. He was in a strong position and he let it slip. Now, part of that is due to the brilliant young fella on the other side, who is going to be a star, it would appear. But then we said that about Dimitrov. It doesn't automatically follow that these players go from enormous promise to realizing that potential. I still refuse to give up hope about Dimitrov, because athletically and talent wise it's still there. If somebody could remove the psychological scar tissue that has built up over the last year and a half, and that is a big psychological scar tissue, I see no reason why he can't compete at the top 10 level again. But it seems a long way off just at the moment.
It's hard not to feel for him, isn't it? I mean, I was discussing it on the phone with my dad last night, and we both concluded that what a joy it was not to be so overburdened with tennis talent in the way that he is. How lucky we are. Some people have had a slightly better week in Indian Wells. I mean, Venus Williams, her return to Indian Wells after 15 years. She lost to Karimi Nara, the qualifier, but the quotes from her about how joyous it was for her to return. She said she couldn't stop smiling throughout the warm-up. It was all very emotional for her. She was overwhelmed by the reception she received. I mean, did we ever think we'd see the day? I certainly didn't.
No, and I didn't think I'd see the day that Serena would come back last year either. A shame, really, that it's inevitably been overshadowed in terms of media spotlight by the sheer magnitude of the news story that we've been reporting the last 7 days. But you're right, I'd hope that is closure now for the Williams sisters on that very unfortunate, unpleasant episode from 15 years ago. But I still think it's marvellous and remarkable that Venus Williams steps foot on any tennis court at the moment because of what she's been through. But given what went on at Indian Wells, that's really uplifting.
Yep, couldn't agree more. Novak Djokovic has lost a set again. Don't call it a crisis, David. What's going on?
Well, and meanwhile, Rafael Nadal's actually won a deciding set. So maybe the world is turning on its axis just at the moment. But look, I mean, Novak Djokovic is going through a spell of mortality just at the moment, I would say, because he had the problem with his eyes that caused him to retire from his match a few weeks ago, and then he was down 2-1 at the Davis Cup. He's lost a set here. We can't expect the guy to just keep on winning as easily as he has been. But actually, you know, it would make things more interesting if he came back to the field a little bit more. But my suspicion is that this is probably just a little blip.
Just a little blip. Now, some food for the soul this week, comeback-wise. Juan Martín Del Potro, how wonderful to see him playing another top-level tennis player again and being able to compete with him. He did eventually lose in straight sets to Thomas Berdych, but particularly that first set, how wonderful a sight was that? I know we saw him in Delray Beach where he played really, really well, reaching the semi-finals there and got that win over Jeremy Shardy, but this felt different, didn't it? Seeing him where he belongs, playing the likes of Thomas Berdych, it felt good, didn't it?
King Kong tennis is what Juan Martín Del Potro invented during the height of his career before the wrist injury started. I still would qualify that, though, with the caveat that he doesn't have the same backhand that he used to have. Not at the moment, anyway. Maybe it's a process of getting confidence in that wrist again before he can properly crack it again. At the moment, he seems to be pushing it. He can unload on the forehand. But let's be honest, it's only 2 or 3 tournaments into that comeback. But, you know, a little bit like the Venus Williams situation. Just thank goodness the guy's back on a tennis court, same as Laura Robson.
There's a reason why so many players talk about a wrist injury being the most hard to come back for. And you mentioned Laura Robson there. She lost first round as well to Rybarikova, but the comments from her after the match were...
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/sports ad free. That's Amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Very, very encouraging, weren't they? She says, for the first time in a long time, she feels completely comfortable going for the ball, striking it as hard as she possibly can, which is her game. She needs to be able to do that in order to have any chance at a comeback, and she intends to play a full schedule now on tour this year.
And you know, I think we underestimate perhaps in our real lives where we don't get to play tennis for a living, but there are things that we take for granted as things we like to do in life. And this is what these people want to do in life. They want to play tennis, most of them anyway. You know, that is, I mean, I think Laura Robson's got other things in her life. I'm sure Martín Del Potro has as well. But it must be crushing not to be able to do what you want to do with your life when you know you're capable otherwise. When everything else is set up perfectly, you're young, you're healthy, you're physically fit, and then one little tiny part of your body is just stopping you. And stopping you for a couple of years. It must be horrible. And I think we said it at the start of the year that was our hope for 2016, to see those two able to play at the top level again. It's still a heck of a long way away, though. Laura Robson has got a lot to come through. But, you know, you've got to start somewhere.
must be good for her to see Juan Martín Del Potro playing the sort of tennis that he hopefully is playing. They shared a surgeon, of course. When Del Potro heard of Laura Robson's wrist injury, he got on the phone to her and recommended his own surgeon. That surgeon is probably eagerly tuning in to all of these matches. You know, his online reviews depend on these results.
Yeah, they do, don't they? But no, great to have them back, and well, long may that resurgence continue.
Absolutely. Whole week of tennis left in Indian Wells. We'll be reviewing it on the podcast next week. But for now, it is our interview with the newly re-elected ATP chairman, Chris Comeau. David has been catching up with him over at the Queen's Club.
Well, it's a beautiful spring day in London. I'm sitting inside the office of the ATP's executive chairman and president, Chris Comeau, who's just been elected for a further 3 years. Congratulations, Chris.
Thanks, David.
And this is the place where you used to oversee the Aegon Championships. It must be quite a nice place to have an office.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, looking out of this window here at the grass courts at Queen's Club, I will always have a huge fondness for this event. You know, it sort of started my almost my career in tennis administration. So, no, it's great. It's a great fondness for it.
Now, Chris Comeau is a retired English tennis player, is what Wikipedia tells me. I vaguely heard something about this many years ago that you used to play the game. What's the actual truth?
Well, the actual truth, Wikipedia, yeah, it's an interesting one, that one, because Wikipedia says that I was a former tennis player. I was a former tennis player of sorts, but a very bad one. So I used to hack around playing what were then satellite events, now challenges. So I have a huge affinity for qualifiers and for challenger players. Also, it says in Wikipedia that I'm Mark Kermode's brother, which I'm not.
Yes, he's a film reviewer for BBC Radio 5 Live. I can categorically state that that is definitely not the case. Now, Chris, obviously the last couple of months have been particularly notable in terms of issues that have arisen, and we'll get onto those in the moment, particularly the ones at the Australian Open with the suspicious betting patterns and the reports that followed. And obviously over the last week or so, we've had the drug testing failed by Maria Sharapova, which has come into the public domain as well. However, generally speaking, over the last 2 years, how has the job compared to what you might have expected it would be?
Well, it's been an incredibly challenging and interesting journey so far, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. And, you know, when I came in almost 2 years ago, one of the first things I wanted to do was, you know, I'd noticed in the past that, you know, the two big emotional issues with the ATP as a structure, which is owned by 50% owned by players and 50% owned by promoters, the two huge areas of conflict are the calendar and obviously prize money. And so rather than have these annual discussions, one of the things I wanted to do was to set it out through to 2018. So, you know, the calendar is set, all the prize money levels are set in Masters 1000s, 500s and 250s. So players know what they're going to get paid, promoters know what they are going to pay. And then it gives us time, a sort of period of calm and stability that we can actually look at the interesting stuff, which is, you know, what can we do as a sports entertainment product to make our, you know, the business of tennis better.
And I imagine at times it is a little bit of a tricky balance, isn't it? Because inevitably, if players want one thing, the tournaments may well want another.
And that's the, you know, that's the challenge. And it's you know, I've always, you know, openly said I believe in the ATP structure so much because I think it's one of the, if not the only sport that is co-owned by promoters and players. But it means that both have a voice at the table, you know, consistently throughout the years. There is dialogue. And whilst it can be tricky at times, I'd much prefer both sides to be working together rather than, you know, sometimes, especially in the States, you have collective bargaining and there's strike action and or threats of strike action and collective bargaining. You know, I think this process, whilst difficult, really is best in the long run.
Now, typically you would oversee the men's tour as a whole. You go to a lot of tournaments. You're involved in all the decision making on the men's side. normally when you get to a Grand Slam tournament, there's often a main players meeting at the outset. You've got many other meetings that you have to go into as well. The Australian Open this year, however, was completely dominated, certainly in the early parts, by the reports into suspicious betting patterns and alleged match fixing by BuzzFeed and the BBC. You would have arrived there, and I know you knew about it pretty early on. How did you come to hear about it, and what was your immediate response?
Well, we were notified, I think, about 3 or 4 days before actually it came out. And, you know, it's something that, you know, all sport is under the spotlight now. I think, especially governing bodies over the past, couple of years, we've heard, you know, governing bodies in other sports, with very, very serious allegations. And, you know, we're just the next in line. And I think, we took a very, very quick decision, I mean, almost within a couple of days of the allegations, of setting up an independent review board, a three-person panel led by Adam Lewis, a QC. And, you know, their job, their remit is to look at everything, about transparency, match fixing, the structure of tennis. And the two things that we've done, which, you know, I was really, really insistent on, one is we're going to publish that report. And two, we've committed to act on every single recommendation. And that's the key on this. You know, the other governing bodies in other sports, and, you know, there's a sort of almost a flavour of the month to have a good look at sports, is what the world doesn't want to see is another sports administrator standing up defending his or her sport, which, you know, I will continue to do so. But in terms of the public perception, to truly believe what I say is real, is you don't have to listen to us. That's the purpose of this review, is have someone independent, and, you know, they will tell us and they will tell the world the findings.
Could be quite expensive.
Yeah, I think it will be very expensive, but we're committed to do that because that's the seriousness that we take, these allegations. Match fixing, I think it's, you know, very important to point out that last year there were 120,000 tennis matches played at, you know, ITF Futures level, at ATP Challenger level, at the 250s, the 500s and the Masters 1000s. And there were, just on the betting alerts that you mentioned earlier, and betting alerts do not mean that there is match fixing. They are just merely an unusual betting pattern that can be influenced by a whole range of factors. But even just on those betting alerts, it was 0.2% in all the matches played. So 99.8% of matches didn't even have a betting alert. And I think that's, you know, is one match too much? Yeah, of course it is. You know, if there was one incident of match fixing, it's too many. But I think this independent review has demonstrating, or by setting up the independent review, has demonstrated, hopefully, that one, we will be very, very transparent. We will acknowledge that we have a zero tolerance of this in the game. And we will do everything we can to eradicate it from our sport.
You mentioned, basically, you feel that maybe tennis is next in line, hence one of the reasons this might have come to light and been looked into. Do you therefore feel that tennis, I mean, you mentioned some of the figures there, tennis doesn't really have much of a case to answer here, that it's not a big problem in the sport?
I think, again, that question is that, you know, there's no need for me to answer, because I think the independent review panel's findings will reveal that. What it has shown is that we need to act with integrity ourselves, with openness and transparency, to show that we are, and demonstrate we are tackling this in the best way that we can. And I believe we do have a very robust process in place. Can we be better? Everybody can be better. So, yes, I think in a way this is not a bad thing to happen to our sport. It's difficult. It's uncomfortable. It's annoying to have to deal with. But actually, a lot of good will come out of it, in terms of that we can. It's always good for, you know, any sport that thinks, or any business that thinks they are totally on top of everything, I think shows an arrogance. And I think, you know, this is the time for us to review everything that we're doing.
What sort of timescale are we looking at for that independent review to reach its findings and yourselves to act upon them?
Again, we didn't want to be seen as giving a for us tennis to be determining what that deadline is. What we wanted to give Adam Lewis and his team, basically, open-ended time frame to do this. He's indicated that it will probably be about a year. It's very, very in depth, and it's open for anybody who's got, suppose any allegations, any evidence, to hand it over to them is a good thing.
One of the talking points that came out of the situation, obviously it was followed up with players, and one or two I heard speak about the fact that they're not allowed to bet on tennis, and yet certain tennis tournaments, the Australian Open included, have betting partners as commercial partners. Where do you stand on that now?
Well, there are two parts of that question. There's the part about should there be a difference between events and promoters being able to have betting partners as opposed to players, and then there's the question about whether either should be. So the first one is, I think it's key to point out that betting is a legal pastime enjoyed by many people around the world. We have a horse racing event over here, the Grand National, where people put on. People who don't normally watch horse racing will put on a £2, £3, £4, £5 bet, and actually it makes the race very enjoyable. So I think to make the jump that suddenly having a betting partner therefore equates to there's match fixing is a bit of a leap. It is a perception issue, and that's why since 1990 the ATP has had a view never to have a betting partner. But individual tournaments, are allowed to. They are individual businesses, and it's their own, choice to do that. I think, players have said, well, if they, if events can have betting partners, why can't we? I think the decision was taken then that the public are used to seeing, and it's commonplace to see betting companies advertising and marketing themselves at events. I think they believed that an individual sport, just the perception-wise, it was a sort of a step too far. And that's continued to be the view. But I think, again, in the independent review, that question might well be answered.
Now, that's one topic that has dominated the discussion over the last couple of months. Another one, as I mentioned earlier, has come up in the last week. It's a week since Maria Sharapova revealed that she had tested positive for a substance, meldonium, and has failed a drugs test accordingly. Now, obviously, that's beyond your jurisdiction, but just generally, in terms of the way that the system works, explain to us, how does it work on an ATP side of things? It's not directly under your jurisdiction.
No, so it's... Before going back over 10 years, the ATP used to run its own anti-doping program, and we were, accused or had, people making comments that we're policing our own players. So, about 10 years ago, there was a decision made and a right decision to be independent from that, to give it over to the responsibility over to the ITF, the International Tennis Federation, who run the program under the WADA code, the World Anti-Doping Organization. And so, players are tested. There's lots of, in-competition testing, increased amount of out-of-competition testing. We introduced the athlete's biological passport, which is hugely helpful, gathering data and shows, if there's big fluctuations in any readings, and that's probably been the biggest leap in this program. But basically how it works is, an athlete is gets tested, a sample is collected, and then it's labelled with a number and not the player's names. So there's a sort of, we can't be accused of covering up the number one player in the world, as important as, for the integrity of the game. It's in our interest to expose every single player, you know, that is caught doing this, because there is a zero tolerance on this. Sample, if it's positive, is then sent to the independent review board. There are three members. There's a lawyer, always a doctor and a scientist, to determine if there is a case to answer, and then it's taken from there. They then notify the ITF, who notifies the player, and then there obviously is the determination. We don't determine how long a player, you know, is banned for, again, for the view of keeping it independent. And so, yeah, it's a very rigorous process, and it's something that, you know, all sport has got to be on top of.
To that end, do you think there's enough testing currently?
Well, again, there's many people, you know, have got a view about how much testing needs to be done. I think you'd have to ask the experts in that field, and people have different views. Lance Armstrong was, I think, the most tested athlete on the planet. And so it is part of the process. It's a major part of the process. But it's about, you know, again, it's being unpredictable in when players are going to be tested. So out of competition, testing is hugely relevant. And adding things like this biological passport is key.
One or two of the comments that I've heard over the last week is whether players are told enough or given enough information that is clearly understood enough in order for them to be on top of if there is a rule change, as there has been in the terms in terms of this substance meldonium, which was for a number of years certainly not on the banned list, and it became on the banned list on January the 1st. What happens at ATP tournaments in terms of your own players, in terms of informing them?
So we have a process that, you know, our communication from the ATP is constant with players. So they are notified at any change at any time of any, you know, change in substance going from a non-banned list to a banned list. Players are also sent communication from the ITF. They are also sent information from WADA themselves. So between the three of us, you know, we do notify players a lot. We've got to keep doing that. We've got to keep on top of that because we don't want anything to fall through the cracks. But ultimately, it is up to the player to be aware of what they're taking.
And to that end, I suppose there's also generally an education piece there as well, isn't there? Both in terms of the potential for corruption and match fixing and the dangers of it and why they shouldn't do it, and also about the importance of being a clean athlete and the processes needed to be going through. Because, I mean, the thing with this is, you know, a cold remedy. We've seen that in the past, haven't we? That it may have something in it. And I've seen players walk around stuffed up with a cold saying, I can't have anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's quite simple. There are things on the list that you cannot take. I was reading an article last week about Mo Farah and, you know, having some coffees before he goes out to race. You know, that's legal. So, you know, but that is a stimulant, but that's okay. So you are aware, every athlete knows what they can and cannot take. And so, you know, if it is a cold or flu remedy and there is ingredients in there that are on the banned list, well, you can't take it.
Pretty simple. And when you put it in those terms, I mentioned the education, there is an ATP university. Is that something that you will look to perhaps beef up a little bit in light of what's come out over the last couple of months?
Well, funny enough, we were going to do that. We started that process a year ago, even pre these allegations. The ATP University is something that's been there for many years. It's a 4-day course where players learn all about anti-doping, anti-corruption, you know, their responsibilities of being a professional athlete. You know, it's that transition from having spent, you know, their younger years, you know, hitting a tennis ball, playing around the world in many places where no one's watching, to suddenly getting onto a stage in front of a global spotlight. So, and, you know, with that becomes, you know, a big responsibility. So these are what we call Division II members, which is where you have to be in the sort of top 500. And they have to attend this course. What we want to do and what we started to look at a year ago was how do we get to the younger kids, you know, who are playing Challengers tours, to start educating them at, you know, 15, 16, 17. So we're starting that process now. It's a what we do with the university, I really believe in it, but I think it's got to be more constant and ongoing. So that there is almost maybe a module based to this. We're at the initial sort of discussions of how we do this, but from an organisation, we want to really, really expand this role.
You mentioned that next generation, and I know there are there's a lot of promotion of this group of a dozen or so young players who there's a lot of excitement about. And I've also remember you were telling us about an under 21 tournament that you planned to run. What is the status of that? Where is it going to be? When's it going to be?
So yeah, this is a hugely exciting project that I've been working on for sort of 18 months now, and it came about from when I grew up as a kid. A player would win a Grand Slam Juniors under 18. And the following year, age 19, be making serious inroads into, you know, world tour events. And now, just because of the sort of the nature of the game, it's so much more physical, so much more dynamic, that players are making that transition from juniors to seniors more, making the breakthrough normally around 23 years old. So the 21 is the new under 18. So that's one reason. The second reason is, we have all been guilty in tennis of just promoting the top four, the big four, over the last decade. And the depth and talent in the men's professional game is so great. And we need to tell the story of many more players. And so for this next generation, sport is about caring who wins over someone else. It's that simple. And unlike a team sport like football, where you have the almost a tribal following, where you support a team that your father or, you know, grandfather supported, you can go and watch a match sometimes where the product on the pitch isn't that great, but you get brought into that whole sense of occasion and it's still a great day out. With an individual sport, you are much more focused on the actual product, whether it's a good match. And so you also need to find hooks where people have an emotional buy-in. That's what it is. It's about caring. So if you're seeing two players that you don't know anything about, it's very difficult to care who wins. But if you are aware of their backstory and where they've come from and, you know, the many different characters, you will find someone that you really are rooting for. So this next generation, we will be able to put them on a platform, piece of theatre to really to highlight how great and interesting and dynamic these next generations are. And then the third point of it is, people talk about, you know, where the game is going in the next 10, 20 years. You know, people are very passionate about views of where the game should be and, you know, changing rules, looking at ways of enhancing the, you know, getting rid of the downtime, increasing the sort of the fever pitch moments. And this will be an event. It will be the season ending 21 and unders, played in the same format as the Barclays ATP World Tour Finals. But we will test case any sort of innovation that we would consider doing.
Stuff like removing the knock-up, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, you know, removing the warm-up is one of my ones, but there are many others.
Why is it one of your ones?
Well, I just, you know, when I, you know, certainly watch it on the television, when you go to a live event, it's okay, because, again, you're caught up in the moment and the atmosphere within the arena. But when you're watching it on television and you see the big, the big theatrics of a, you know, player walking onto the court and there's a big moment and then it drops dead for a period where, you know, they're getting rackets out, they're, you know, doing their shoelaces up, then there's a 5-minute warm up, then they go back to the bench. And, you know, it can be, you know, 8 to 15 minutes at times, and it's too long. And I think, you know, it doesn't need to be that long. So I want to look at that. But there are many others that people throw in. And the good thing about this is that...
Shot clock? In terms of the time between points?
Yeah, there's shot clock. There's you know, no lets. There's no ad scoring. There's, you know, should the tiebreak be at 5-all, not 6-all? There are so many. But, the, you know, what is great about this and exciting about this is I want to ask, there are sort of five key stakeholders in tennis, and often sport gets very almost arrogant in its approach of predicting what people want. What I want to do is actually ask people where they would like the game to be, and that's players, that's promoters, that's fans, that's media and sponsors, and go, what do you think? And let's have some fun with this and see what works. So there'll be some ideas that you think are going to be horrendous, and actually when you do it, may work, and other ideas that you think are going to be really, really good and you find they don't add very much at all. But let's see.
So the two final questions there then are, where is this under 21 tournament going to be and when? And once you've trialed them out, how do you actually, what process has to be gone through for them to be proposed and brought into the reality of professional tennis?
Well, the second question is the more difficult one. The first one's quite easy. We have five cities that are looking to host this event. There's been huge amounts of interest, which is great. And by the end of April, we will whittle that five down to sort of two or three. And then hopefully April will make that decision of where it's going to be. We want it to be in a place where, tennis is welcomed and has a big following. And in a media, friendly time zone to get the maximum exposure. In terms of implementing any change, that is the challenge, because we're not solely responsible for it. Obviously, you have the women's tour, you have the Grand Slams, and so we don't want to make changes for change's sake. That's the key. We just want to see, are there ways that we can enhance the game, and make it even better? I do believe tennis is one of the best sports entertainment products in the world at the moment. But you can't be complacent and think that it's going to be, stay as relevant as it is now going forward without having a good internal look.
But 2017 is when the under 21 tournament will take place. You've got another 3 years of this. Do you think we might see any changes before you finish that term?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's an exciting time for tennis, because I think, as I said, the relationship between the promoters and players is probably the best it's ever been. I think, certainly the stats show that tennis has been the best place it's ever been. We had over 1 billion people watching ATP tennis events last year, and on-site attendance at 4.5 million is a record amount of people who are coming out to watch the product. So commercially, we're in the best place we've ever been. There's been a 245% increase in commercial revenues since 2009. So all the indicators are good, but you just cannot stand still. It's a very, we live in a very fast moving world where, even how people consume, the product, how they consume media has changed so dramatically even in the last 5 years. My children, unfortunately, have never paid for anything in their life. They seem to watch movies and sport and download music for free, which is a constant annoyance to me. But that's just the way the world has worked. So how do we engage with, we talk about the next generation of players, but we need to be really, really aware of the next generation of fans as well.
That's the future, and you're going to be part of it. We know that for the next 3 years. Congratulations on the re-election, Chris, and thanks for joining us here on the Tennis Podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks, David.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.